If scary movies give you dread, keep you up late night in bed, here's a podcast that will help you ease your mind. We'll explain the plot real nicely, then we'll talk about what's frightening so you never have to have a spooky time. It's Ruined.
Hello, welcome to Ruined. I'm Hallie.
I'm Allison.
And this is a podcast where we ruin a horror movie just for you. And this is a bruise on my chin because I was in a car crash.
Yes.
A car has crashed. Two cars crashed.
How you feeling? How you doing?
My neck hurts. My neck, my back, my pussy, and my crack. The whole thing.
Yeah.
The whole system is falling apart.
Yep.
Just to give you guys sort of paint a picture. I was in an Uber.
Peek behind the curtain.
I was in an Uber, in the back of an Uber, and we were trying to exit the beautiful 101 highway here in Los Angeles. And so, like, we were backed up onto the highway. You know, people were waiting at the top of the exit for the light. And the car behind us just, I don't know what happened. I think the person might have been texting or looking away, just fucking plows into us.
Yeah.
And my head whips back, and my head then whips forward, and I hit my chin on my chest. And my jaw, like, snapped shut. And I was like, boy, I don't know what you do. Because we're also, like, just still on the highway. And people are, like, honking, and it's, like, mayhem.
It's scary. When I was in high school, my friend was driving us to a regatta for rowing, and we were crossing the Bay Bridge in Maryland, which is an extremely long, I don't want to say it's the longest bridge in America, because I don't think that that's true, but it's,
I'm
like.
I'm looking it up. Let's see. It could be. It's certainly in the top.
Let's find out if it is. It's very, it's up there.
Okay.
It's a long bridge. Like, it's, you're on it for a very long time.
All right. Let's see.
Let's see.
No, it's coming up the Manchoc Swamp Bridge, which is a concrete trestle bridge in Louisiana.
Oh,
wow. It's 22.8 miles long. That is quite a long bridge.
I guess that's like a swamp bridge. I mean, I guess it is still a bridge. Like, you still have to go down underwater to, like, put in the structure.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine that's a kind of a tough bridge to set up.
That's got to be. But the Bay Bridge is very long, and like a quarter of the way into the bridge, traffic stopped and my friend slammed into the car in front of us.
Oh my God.
And it was very abrupt, and like there was nobody, we barely had like Nokia cell phones at that time. We just like, so like, it's not like anybody was like on their phone, but like, it was just like all of a sudden, like you're driving fast on a bridge and then all of a sudden it stops. We hit the car in front of us, not very terrible, but it stopped bridge traffic, and it, like, it was a Friday afternoon, like, at the end of the summer, like, September, like, early fall, and it was, like, a huge traffic day, and we just, like, it was, like, on the news, and it was a minor accident, but, like, you're on a bridge, like, you have
terrifying.
To, like, I already don't like being on a bridge just as a passenger in
think,
a car.
What if I just got out
What if
and
I
jumped?
Just got out and jumped?
What if I didn't have to do all this stuff anymore?
And I just said goodbye.
I just want to correct myself. Does anyone else notice or feel that Google is becoming worse and worse? We're not tech people, you know this, but I Googled longest bridge. It gave me Manchoc Swamp Bridge. To be fair, okay, I shouldn't trust the first, you know, it just tells you something. And then I go down and it's like, it's actually the Lake Pontchartrain Causeway, also in Louisiana. And I'm like,
this all makes sense because, like, it's like an archipelago, basically.
But then, like, literally, like, immediately, there's, like all of the results starting in the middle of the first page is, like, the sources are, like, a/z/animals.com. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's not giving me, like, there has to be, a bridge association website that has this kind of shit. Like, it's just garbage links. Immediately, and I swear to God, it didn't used to be like that.
It's like the first five are ads that are like leggings.
Yes.
Did you want to buy leggings? And you're like, what? How does this set? Like, or it's like tunnels, and you're like, no, bridge. And like, it really is getting worse. It's not good.
Oh,
so
boy, yeah.
Anyway,
there's different bad links, and they have like different. I don't know. This is very. Yeah, it's not good.
Even like when I'll type in, like, when I'm looking for like recipes for like a simple thing that like is clearly. And again, this is like, Google is not a cookbook, and I have like a million cookbooks, and I should just like open up the joy of cooking to be like, how do you make veal marsala or whatever, like something.
Yeah.
And it's like, I Google like, what's the basic like go-to easy recipe? And it's always like a blog with like no review, like not even like a popular blog, just like a blog.
And it's so filled with ads, you like can barely get to the actual content of the recipe.
And it's like,
it's not
Google,
good.
Come on, if I'm looking for this, like you gotta serve me like the New York Times and like Bon Appetit first, you know?
Yeah, so weird. Sabrina, our editor says, or our producer says, and the reviews are all, can't wait to try it. Yeah. Right. Five star.
Yeah, no one
not actually eaten it. Yeah. Anywho, just about the car accident, I'm doing okay. My neck hurts, which I feel a deep understanding of Allison's robo neck now, as in Cyborg Solidarity. Yes. I will say the weirdest part has been I've never taken muscle relaxers before.
They are a wild ride.
I was having a good time. I actually took a muscle relaxer and listened to Christmas music. Now that's the vibe I'm looking for. Then, of course, as I was texting both Allison and Sabrina, our producer, I was like, I have to run to the restroom. And then I texted them 15 minutes in to say, hey, I'm fighting for my life in there. Okay, I swear to God, I'm going to try to wrap this up. But it is an all-out
What did they
war.
Give you?
Oh, I didn't even look. I can text you after.
It starts with a C?
It doesn't matter. Yeah, it starts with a C.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I take a full one, and I barely am done drinking the glass of water I have it with before I'm asleep.
Damn. Yeah, I had a half. Like, I didn't take
nothing puts you to bed like a muscle relaxer, and if I don't want to advocate for using drugs for other purposes.
I know, this is so hard. It's like, it's simply a part of life.
If you're having muscle pain.
Yeah.
If you're having muscle pain or having stiff, you know, that's what it's for.
And
if they're prescribed to you by an actual doctor.
And it was. It was this guy just standing on the side of the highway and he handed it to me. And I'm like, yeah, that's
like,
what a doctor is.
Yeah, like just like those lawyers that are like ambulance chasers. He's just like a pharmacist.
There are two industries in Los Angeles, the TV and film and then personal injury attorneys. So there are so many ads for different ones. And my favorite one is this woman called Veronica because she has her German Shepherd in the ad. Mm. And the most recent ad is her in a suit and then the German Shepherd in a suit. And I think they're building up to the fact that, like, Veronica is actually the German Shepherd and the woman's just a model that, like, Veronica, the sentient personal injury attorney German Shepherd, had to hire to, like, segue people into it.
I would love that.
But, yeah, I don't know. I my friend's mother, Lindsay, I don't know if you're listening. My friend's mother, I texted him at the group chat, like, oh, my God, this thing happened. And my friend's like, yeah, you should go get your neck checked out. My mom was in a car accident when she was 30, and they sent her home from the hospital. And it turns out she had a cracked vertebrae because they didn't do an x-ray.
Oh, my God.
But then when I went to go in, I said, can I just get an x-ray? They're like, oh, we don't just hand out x-rays. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'll take these pills. And hopefully my head won't slide off my fucking shoulders between now and a couple days from now. But I think it's fine. I feel like it's even getting better now.
Seems attached.
The American healthcare system, you know how we do. And then I just want to show you this thing that Dave drove me to urgent care because we were meeting, ex-boyfriend of the pod, Dave, we were meeting up for lunch anyways. And he handed this to me in CVS, and so I bought it. So it's to cheer me up. And it is a little tiny fake Oscar that says Best Woman.
Woman.
Here I am.
A statue. Also, is that statue a man?
Yes. Because is it a man? Really? If you think about it, the Best Woman.
The Best Woman is a man.
Yeah.
So he says, you really are collecting a lot of upright, solid men or upright, solid like figures.
That's
for
true.
Your
yeah.
Home.
I mean, I my feelings about gender, which is really, yes. We're still doing that.
It's a construct.
So I do see what you're saying, and I do need to have some more femme statues.
I don't mean that it's gendered. I just mean like you have a lot of like between the Nutcrackers and this guy, like you have a lot of just like figures.
No, but I wanted to figures with like huge tits. You know what I mean? I want an overtly feminine statue. I just said they don't sell them at Target yet.
Yeah.
If you see a statue with huge cans, please let me know. I'm happy to add it.
Someone in LA makes that.
Oh, yeah.
You know someone in LA is making that.
I do want,
the AVN Awards. I'm sure that's what they give out.
Yeah. I mean, I if they have any class of decorum. Search for an apartment is hopefully nearing an end. So I do want to decorate. And the thing I'm coveting for myself for the holidays is getting something from Seth Rogen. Like, he has
house plant. Yeah.
So it's like weed and also like
gorgeous.
His clay, you know, like there's like a little like Lazy Susan and all these like really gorgeous little, clay things. So I might treat myself.
Give it a whirl.
Are you going to get yourself a gift for the holidays? Is that something you do?
My birthday is in the holiday season, so I usually buy myself a birthday gift, which I don't know what that's going to be this year. We're recording this in earlier December, and my birthday is in later December. And I don't know. I spent a lot of money on myself this year for no reason. So I'm like, I don't know. Do I really need to spend more? Like, we're closing out in the end of the year fiscally. I'm just like, what are we doing?
But
I'll probably get myself some, like, dumb thing. Like, some Vince sweater that's on sale. And I'll be like, I deserved it. And, like, that'll be it.
No, I mean, I think, you know, I definitely spent through my pandemic terror and continue to do so.
Same. You know. Yeah. No, my coping mechanism is spending money.
Yeah.
And I don't always earn in a way that lets that be reasonable.
I mean, we're the all of us were in that situation. Yes. Well, let us begin. We are doing, Allison, I think you recently mentioned how much you enjoyed the anthology episode. So we're doing an anthology.
I haven't, but in the future I have.
Oh, yes. You mentioned it in a future episode.
In the future, I'm going to say that I like when we do anthology films, mm-hmm. and this serves that statement.
Yes, you were correct through time, and I knew that in the past, so that's why
we're both all knowing of each other and nothing else.
Oh, and that's really nice. I just want to say before we start that actually, I work with someone, I work at Crooked Media, which is a podcast company, and one of the video editors, Ben Heathcote, is actually in this movie and helped make this movie and is incredibly talented. So, Ben, a shout out to you. And
I love that.
Yeah. So I'll call out which segment he's in. And just nice. Again, a perk of living in LA. It's like, oh, yeah, you.
Just randomly in shit.
Yeah, like when our friend Julia Johns dated the actor who played the mother in Barbarian.
Oh, yes.
Well, that's fun to know, isn't it? All right, so let's begin. We're doing the Mortuary Collection. We always like to have Allison watch the trailer. Allison, what did you feel about the Mortuary Collection trailer?
I mean, again, as I've said in the future and in the past and currently in the present, I do love an anthology like horror film, because I think like it's just so well suited for it.
Yeah.
Like drama can't, it's like, what can you learn in 15 minutes that's going to be a satisfying ending? But horror like does it so well. But the trailers are always really complicated because you're just seeing like cuts of a million different scary things. And it's like, you're like, how many people are in this? And then it's like, oh, right. There's like five stories to tell. But it does seem like this one has a real like organizing principle story that's like really carrying us through. And I'm excited to kind of hear about that.
It has a very satisfying through line in a way that some of the anthologies we've done don't necessarily have so much, I think. But we always like to take a baseline scary as well. Allison, how scary do you find the concept of, I feel like we've done this before, but the concept of the immutable reality of fate?
Oh. Do you believe in fate?
No. God, no.
Yeah, me neither. So,
no.
I don't believe in that. So, I guess of all of the things, not that scary.
I guess I understand why people want to believe in it, because it is very reassuring. Same thing with, like, oh, God is watching over you, or, like, things happen for a reason.
Sure, of course. It's nice to believe, like, I, like, totally and have absolutely in my mind, like, not, like, a direct, like, this was fate, but being like, oh, of course all these things happened in this order. It was so this thing could happen. And it's like, no, that's not, it's like, actually those things are causation and, like, what, like, that's not what reality is. But, like, I do see after the fact sometimes, like, putting together the, like, of course, that's why you didn't get that job, because you needed to get this job. And it's like, no.
I know. It's like,
because I didn't think that in the 10 other jobs I didn't get before that. Like,
right. Yeah. It's, I guess it is like we live in such a chaotic, unknowable world that the idea of fate is such a solace, especially when something good does happen. Cause it's like, oh, I knew I didn't have to go through all this horrible shit for no reason.
Yeah. It's like horoscopes. I feel the same way. It's
absolutely.
If I read it before the time period that it's talking about, like that the day or the week or the month or whatever, it's like, but if I read it after the fact, I'm like, the 26th was a good day because I did have a turkey sandwich instead of eggs. Like, okay, that's not anything. But like you retroactively fit that reality into this like construct that isn't real. So,
and I guess
all that to say, I don't believe in fate.
Yeah. And I guess as we say this, it's like there are certain like the way that our society is structured, like it propels people towards certain futures. So it's sort of like fate it is something that is just out of your control. Like, I guess we do fate people in certain ways, good and bad, mostly bad. So, yeah, I guess it's like we are puppets of larger forces, but I don't know. I don't like that. That bums me out too. So like the good version of fate is kind of a bummer, and the bad version's also, I don't know. There's something about it.
It's a no-win, as is the entire human condition.
Yeah. So with that in mind, would you like to guess the twist? And so I think I'm going to have you guess the twist for the framework. Sort of, and just to set it up, we're about to get into it, but a young woman goes to sees a help wanted sign at a mortuary and meets the mortician who tells her stories about the people who have died in the mortuary, or whose bodies have been delivered there. It's sort of similar to body bags, which we just recently did. Allison, would you like to guess the twist in the mortuary collection?
Guess the twist.
I mean, I'm going to guess that guy's dead.
And I'm going to do something. I know this is a little out of the box, and maybe it's just the muscle relaxer talking, but I'm going to give that to you. Of course he's fucking dead, but what is he doing past death? You know what I mean?
But what does he do? I was going to say that the mortuary is not like on Earth and a mortuary, but is in fact like hell or some kind of like hellscape.
Okay,
and
great.
She has already died, but doesn't know it, and she's the last story.
Love it. Allison, I mean, honest to God, you're writing these movies at this point.
I mean,
and we will be.
Hundreds of movies in, I'm finally starting to understand some of the tropes and motifs of horror.
Yeah, this is a Saw-like induction to you understanding the formula of a horror movie, right? But you don't have to, like, crawl through razor wire for it. You just have to mentally crawl through razor wire when I tell you about the horrible shit that's going to happen.
Yeah, that is what happens, so.
Let us begin. We hear the voice of our, you know, sort of our narrator, or one of our main characters, Mortician Montgomery Dark, and he is played by character actor Clancy Brown, who I associate with most closely with the voice of Mr. Krabs on SpongeBob.
Seen 1 second of SpongeBob, and it's memed the fuck all over every social media, and it makes me so angry because I'm like, I don't understand this.
That's a good point, because I'm looking at Clancy Brown's IMDb page, and SpongeBob started in 1999, which really was the perfect time for something to become, I mean, both for people who are like our age around the time, and then anyone then born after that, you've seen it other than you. But he's like a very well-known, he's done a million like voice acting roles. He also was in Shawshank Redemption. He plays Captain Hadley, who's sort of like the hard-nosed, like piece of shit, you know, like a prison captain. So he's definitely a character actor you would recognize, and he has this very beautiful, deep, sonorous voice that is extremely recognizable. And we hear him say, "The world is not made of atoms; it is made of stories." And we open on a beautiful aerial shot of a little newspaper delivery boy biking through a coastal town of Raven's End, which I think is supposed to be like the Pacific Northwest. And they set it up very quickly, like, this is sort of akin to Stephen King's Castle Rock. You know, it's like a little town. It's near the water. And things are perhaps already pretty bad, you know. And we see a telephone pole covered in missing posters. We see a fisherman hauling like a tentacled creature out of the water in a cage. We see a newspaper that's thrown. And the headline says, "Boggy Bay Tooth Fairy Still at Large."
No.
I'm also not sure what time period, like, they have, like, very 50s-looking cars, but then, like, we meet people who are more modern, so I think we're supposed to be in sort of a timeless American limbo, right?
Fabulous.
So we see a little boy, he bikes up a long hillside path and climbs steps to the Raven's End Mortuary, and he sees there's a big pile of newspapers at the bottom of the steps that are uncollected. And we see the headlines, "Ride at Kirksdale Asylum," "Creature spotted in local waters." So feeling like he can't just leave it in the pile, he takes the newspaper all the way up to the steps to the house, to the mortuary. And it's gorgeous, overlooks the bay, and he rings the doorbell, but nobody answers. So he tries to peer through the mail slot, and he has like a camera. And
I'm glad we don't have mail slots anymore. I'm just going to say that.
You know, I guess it's The utility's there, but then you just imagine somebody, you look down and somebody's looking at you, right?
Well, it just seems like way too much access to the inside of the house for someone who's on the outside of the house.
Now, what would your concern be with regards, are you concerned they're going to put their penis through the slot? Is that what we're thinking?
One, we know that that's happened a lot. There's no way it hasn't. If there's an opening, a man has put his dick in it. That's just right. What's going on. But like, even just like, it's like not far enough away from the doorknob that like you could definitely like, you don't have to be like a mastermind of engineering to get something in there to like open up a door from the outside.
But I feel like, wouldn't we know if people were doing that? I feel like that'd be more of an epidemic. Right.
I just like, mean like we don't really have mail slots anymore. It, and yeah. I think if we did, they would.
And you know, I think to me the opening, the door opening that would cause me concern is a doggy door. You don't see those anymore.
Oh
either.
Yes, of course. Well, they're on TikTok.
Oh,
it's always like a fat cat getting stuck in it. And I'm like, I like that.
And that's I guess nice. Like a raccoon getting in or something is still cute. But yeah, you just don't want to look down and see a man trapped midway through.
No, of course not.
Again, trying to, his dick's caught in the mail slot and he's caught in the doggy door.
Yeah, he's upside down. He's tried to 69 your house.
Trying and succeeding.
I mean, clearly.
And then legally, that's his house now. Because yeah. I'm sorry, that's just yeah. the Supreme Court. These activist judges.
That's how real estate works.
When the little boy goes to open the mail slot to take a photo inside, the flash illuminates that there's a pair of eyes staring back at him. Terrifying. Because nope. also that mail slot's like 6 inches from the floor. And the hand reaches and grabs the strap on his camera and like jerks him towards the door. The door swings open and he is face to face with the mortician Montgomery Dark. And little boy tries to run away and Montgomery's still holding his camera and says, "Oh, you forgot your camera." And the boy screams, "Suck it, creepo," and bikes away.
That's an amazing phrase.
And Montgomery goes inside. He throws the camera into a box with, like, these other confiscated kids' items. Like, obviously, children come here to, like, you know, pester him. He checks his pocket watch, and he turns the sign from closed to funeral in progress. So the funeral is about to start, and there's also a help wanted sign sort of perch underneath the Ravens End Mortuary sign out front. During the funeral, Montgomery delivers like an epilogue that's actually like really impassioned. And he, you know, he's giving this plea. His eyes are closed. He's sort of raptured. He's like,
"I beseech you, friends, that even as we mourn, let us celebrate as a tribute to this young man's story."
But nobody's hearing it and nobody's interested because Allison, it is, of course, a funeral for a child. Whew. You hate to see it. So everyone's like, okay, yeah, that's, yes, in theory, what you're saying is true, but that's true if you're 100. That's true if you got to live a life. If you're a 6-year-old blonde boy, you didn't really get to do a lot of stuff, you know?
No, that ain't the feeling.
So everyone leaves kind of like, okay, whatever. And Montgomery checks his watch again and flips the sign back to close as just as a storm starts to roll in over the bay. And when he goes to place a book back on the shelf, a figure walks behind him into the viewing room. And when he turns back out, there's a young woman named Sam. And he said, "I'm sorry, how did you know the boy?" And she said, "I'm not here for the funeral. I'm actually here because of the help wanted sign. Are you still looking?" And he smiles and he says, "Always." And he has such an incredible deep voice. Like, all these lines, again, are chewing. Voice. He's having such a blast.
Yes.
He invites Sam into his study, which is filled with books and sort of like, you know where there'll be like a preserved butterfly with like a glass hood over it?
Yes.
And ooh, that. Crystals, you know, fossils. That's what I'm talking about.
I like that vibe.
Yeah. So he explains that everyone has a story. And in all the books in his studies, it's not just a story of how their death happened, but why. And so Sam's like, "Well, I'm already here. Would you tell me one of the stories?" And he's like, oh, no. It's too dark, you know. She says, no, if I'm going to work here, I want to know. I want to know the stories. I really want to know what's going on. I want something dark, twisted, and awesome. Which brings us to our first story. And this is a little tiny baby story, and to the point where it doesn't even have a name, but this is our story number one. And Allison, we see a woman named Emma in like sort of a 1950s dress, like a yellow dress. She ducks into a bathroom with a glass of wine, and she looks and notices the inside handle is covered in like a clear slime. I've been to those parties before.
Lube.
A man knocks on the door and she's in there and tells her, "I hope you're not hiding from me. I think there's really something between us. I'll meet you on the veranda." When she leaves, we see her take a seat in the closed toilet and she like gulps her wine before taking the garbage can.
Good old toilet wine. The other kind.
Oh, nothing like going to a party and drinking wine in the bathroom on the toilet. Oh my God. That keeps me going. So
is that clear slime from the vaginal version of 69ing a house?
Yeah, exactly. Like if you're a woman, you have to fuck a door handle, a doorknob, then you own the bathroom. You know what I mean? So you didn't get the whole house. True.
And then you get to drink all the wine you want.
Right. But we're working up to the fact that if you fuck enough doorknobs in the house, then you will also acquire the house.
Yes.
It's all about legal precedent in this country, unfortunately. Yeah. We're going to get there. We see Emma reach into her dress and pull out several men's wallets. And we're to understand she just lifted them from men's pockets during the party.
Love her.
Takes the cash out, dumps them in the garbage, puts the top back on. Even more memorably, she has stolen the same pocket watch that we've seen Montgomery has been using. So we do see these sort of like tokens and like connecting threads between the framework and the actual stories. Mm-hmm. Allison, she's finished her toilet wine. She's ready to go join whoever his name is on the veranda. She hears a thud behind the medicine cabinet as if something is knocking on the inside of the door. Allison, let me ask you, what would you do?
What would you do?
So I'm at a party. I've stolen a bunch of stuff. I just pounded some wine in the bathroom. I don't know about the slime.
Well, you've seen the slime, but I think much like we did, well, this is just vaginal mucus. It's on a doorknob. Yes. Like you might find it at a party. This is a popping off. This is a party that we want to be at. Okay. There is shit. There's fluids everywhere. Okay. Everywhere. That's that kind of party that they're having.
It's a good party. And then the guy's knocking. I've tossed the wallets. And what just happened?
She's heard a knock from behind the medicine cabinet.
Yes. I would just exit the bathroom and then the house.
Same.
That would be, I would be like, well, that's enough. I kind of got what I came for, which is toilet wine and a bunch of cash.
Yeah.
So I'm going to wrap it up.
Which is how they pay you for most of your stand-up sets now.
Yes, this is true. Toilet wine and cash, and then you leave a house. I'm out of there.
Yeah. Unfortunately, she instead goes to the cabinet, and we see her sort of deliberate, like, actually, I'm going to open this and steal a bunch of medication, but it's locked. So she uses a nail file to break open.
I'm
going to
say that wasn't something I would also do.
And as she's doing it, she slices her hand with the nail file and the door slams shut. Then she starts full on fighting to open the door. It's like, what are you doing? Like, you already have the cash. Also, something is thumping around behind the medicine cabinet, which again is supposed to be only about this deep, right?
Nope. Yeah. Except for that one TikTok where it was a whole apartment.
Oh, yeah, it was a whole apartment. God, I forgot about that. Unfortunately, Emma gets the door open. Instead of a cat medicine cabinet, she full of delicious pills, she finds a passageway to a void filled with tentacled horrors dripping.
I mean, at a party, I don't hate seeing a void as an option, but no tentacles.
I'm going to stop you there. So as she tries to slam the medicine cabinet door shut, and she's screaming for help, only to have the creatures on the other side, they stop struggling. She's like, oh, I guess I'm allowed to leave. So she starts to quietly tiptoe to the door, only to drop the pocket watch. And the sound of it shattering coincides with the medicine cabinet door bursting open, and sort of a thick column of meaty tentacles jets out. Elsa, you've been here before, and grabs her up, drenching her in clear slime, and she's kicking and screaming through the doorway, and she hits the medicine cabinet door vertically, right? So she's like, essentially being jammed vertically against it. And she's pulled, her body starts to break backwards. So her spine breaks backwards.
Okay, well, yeah, this is familiar.
Yeah, exactly. And
this part I understand.
And until she, of course, shatters in half, basically, and then dies. So she sort of becomes a rag doll, her spine broken. And the tentacles pull her away into the void, and the door closes.
Are they the same tentacles we saw with the fisherman in the...
I think so. I think we're to think this is... That was maybe a little version of what these things are. Yes, so I think there are a piece. Back in the mortuary, Sam's like, oh, okay, well, that was a fun story. I thought there'd be maybe a little bit more to it, which I did think was funny because watching it, that is my exact thought. I'm like, well, it was fun. We're like, just a little bit more would have been something. And, you know, she says, I was expecting an ironic twist or some kind of thematic comeuppance, but... That was fun.
Looking for those things.
And Montgomery says, oh, well, I was just warming up, you know? And he's like, well, if you're going to work here, I need you to just basically sign some paperwork. Also, what I tell you is, you know, it's personal. This is essentially an NDA. And she goes and signs it. And she says, well, don't you think that sounds a little far-fetched, like an octopus in a medicine cabinet? And he's like, it wasn't an octopus. It was an allegory. It's about the story. And she's like, okay, great. I get it. Like, the moral is don't stick your nose where it doesn't belong. And he says, no, you'd think that would be the answer. But actually, it's about universal balance. You know, causality, one action begets another. You know, that's the important lesson.
Is he saying, like, the wallet stealing is why she got sucked into the octopus cabinet?
Yes. I think that's what we're supposed to think, which, again, seems unfair. I love that.
That's not eye for an eye.
Yeah, I wouldn't invite her back to the next doorknob fucking party, but like...
I don't know if she needs to get split in half at the waist.
Exactly. I mean, and if, again, if that's what she's into, that's fine, but you've got to let people know at the party, by the way, there's an octopus void in the bathroom.
Yeah, of course.
Sam signs the document, Montgomery starts showing her around. So he shows her the foyer, and there's photos of all the previous morticians on the wall. And as he walks on, Sam looks at the photo.
Like a fraternity.
Yeah, basically. A fraternity of men in ill-fitting suits.
Fraternity.
Yeah. She sees what looks like Montgomery, but the photo looks like it's 60 or 70 years old. It looks exact. Well, it looks a little bit younger, but he's like an older man. The timeline wouldn't make sense.
Okay.
And then once they get to the viewing room, Sam starts to open the coffin, and he sort of snaps it shut and tells her, I'm not going to tell you about this boy's death. Some tales are too unsettling for even me to recount.
Okay.
She's like, oh, okay, well, like, can you tell me another one? And he says, well, you've heard better safe than sorry. This young man had to learn it the hard way. So now we're in a segment, or story two, called Unprotected. And we are at a college campus. Again, is it the 60s? Is it the 90s? Is it 2000? I don't know. But it's sort of that liminal space, right? And I guess it's supposed to be the 60s because we see this frat brother, Jake, basically come out and start hard pitching these female co-eds, like first years. Basically, you know, like Karl Marx has always said, like, you can tell where society is at based on its treatment of women. We believe here at whatever college this is in total sexual liberation. And he says, as a straight white male, I'm going to be the first to admit that the tides are turning, the patriarchy is falling, and past it is a world of sexual pleasure, provided we do it safely. Now, the problem with that pitch is, like, I do believe that. So, like, hearing that, I'm like, okay, well, I understand we're setting him up that he doesn't actually believe that, but I believe that.
Yeah, but I believe that.
And he shows him how to unroll a condom out of a banana in a very horny way. And this segment was, like, very, like, horny in a great way. And so, of course, all these women are like, oh, great, yeah, no, I would absolutely fuck this guy. And they each grab a condom while he invites them to the fraternity's party that night. And when the girls leave, he has two other frat bros, Connor and Todd. And Connor's like, whoa, is that true about the patriarchy? And the other bro says, no, you idiot. The patriarchy is doing just fine. Jake, explain your theory. And Jake tells him, like, here's what we're doing. Like, we are providing these freshmen, first years with information so they can make informed decision. And that decision will be to fuck you two losers. And basically the rationale is, like, all the women who take condoms are down to fuck, so those are the women we're going to invite to the party, right? And Connor's like, that's genius. That's how we meet all the sluts, you know?
But that's how you meet the women who are practicing safe sex.
Right, exactly. You meet a woman who, like, it's like every woman, not whatever, but, like, yeah, it's like the logic
is most women want to fuck. They just don't want to get fucked over.
Right. Like, and this is what this story is about, of course. And Connor spots this, again, beautiful young woman, Sandra, who's walking into the building behind them. Tries to chase her down and is, like, using Jake's logic and lines, but, like, he's just eating shit. Like, he doesn't remember, like, what he was talking about. He's just trying to talk to this woman.
It's off, yeah.
Jake comes up to him and says, hey, you know, the girls' lacrosse team just arrived in the booth. You should go talk to them. And Connor's like, a whole team! And he runs out. And Jake's talking to Sandra, and she says, well, you don't look like a first year. And he's like, oh, no, I just come to things to get laid, jokingly. And Sandra says, me too. And it sort of throws off his whole spiel because he's like, oh, I was joking. And she just stares at him. And he's like, oh, okay. And Connor rushes back over like, I need your help. We're out of bananas. But not before Jake invites Sandra to the big Sig Delt house party that night. And Sandra says, I'll think about it. And she takes the condom. Allison, as she walks away, we see a corkboard covered in missing posters for missing students, like at least a dozen, all of whom are male. At the house party, We see Jake, you know, and this is like a lot of like, it is just like this is a story about a man with a deep insecurity, and his deep insecurity is that he used to be fat as a kid, which as a fat person now is very funny to me. But when he's doing something that it's like, okay, he's looking at a photo of himself as a fat little kid. And it's like, you have a framed photo of yourself as a fat little kid that you look at to like lift weights or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And so somebody knocks on the door and he puts his little fat self away and he just returns to shirtlessly lifting weights. And Connor comes in with shots like, why don't you come downstairs, man? The party's getting started. He's like, I'm just laying low, you know. Connor sees a pair of underwear, women's underwear on Jake's bed. And I guess we had this at college where like, if you did the college laundry, it had like a code for your name, but it wasn't so they could keep track of it, but it wasn't like your actual name. So Connor picks up the panties and says, it written on it is the full name of the woman who is the head of the history department. And I'm like, what kind of laundry system is this where this woman's full name is written on her underwear somewhere?
And she's not like a student.
And I guess if I worked on campus, I would use the campus laundry, I suppose.
Yeah,
I guess. But it's just funny. And Connor's like, oh my God, I can't believe you fucking bagged a MILF. Like, how do you get all these chicks? And Jake tells him it's easy. And he's like, they want sex and a companion. They just want to feel like they're worth it. And now he's talking about himself as a little fat kid. You know, it's like,
right, of course.
You just want to feel like you're worth it. If you can give that to a girl, even for one night, you can have any girl you want. And Todd busts in shouting. Calm down. He's like a bottle of whiskey. He's like, I am a robot and this is my fuel. And then he just starts chugging it.
Okay, what is that, an impression of me?
Yes. Yeah, I was just doing it says Allison Libby impression in the captions.
I am a robot and whiskey and alcohol is my fuel.
And the guys are all like, hooray. And they all go downstairs to booze and cruise for coos. So Jake is like holding court. At one point he does like a card trick. I'm like, okay, Jake, like you don't have to do all that, you know?
It's
like
too much. You're doing too much.
But also like these women are there for, you know, many of them are there to like actually meet up and hook up with you guys. Like it's like,
yeah, there you don't need to like literally trick them into like,
I mean, I guess I do think we tell men that. And I think it does cause a lot of psychic trauma to everyone involved. Yep. I don't know why. And,
don't know.
So if you're a man listening to this, you know that you're great. Please just accept it yourself that you are great. You don't have to trick anyone into sex with you.
No.
And if they're into some sort of weird card game thing, that's all you can discuss with them. If you ever do some sort of
card
sexual
game sex,
some sort of sleight of hand sexual magic, that's something for you to discuss together.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
But you know, as soon as he sees Sandra walk in, it is fucking on. Like they are like basically walking through this party with their eyes locked on each other, and she goes up to him and they immediately kiss. So they head back up, they head up to Jake's room, and Sandra's like, oh, you're really going to like let me come in your room? You barely know me. Aren't you afraid for your safety? I could be a serial killer. And Jake's like, haha, are you? And Sandra just pushes him down on the bed before they start stripping. And it's kind of like hot. Like Jake's sort of like laying on bed, and she crawls on a bed, like her shirt off, and straddles him. And she tells him, I have something for you. And she reaches behind her and pulls from her skirt the condom that he gave her earlier. And Jake's like, oh, we don't really need a condom. You know what I mean? Like, if you're on the pill, it's fine. You know, we don't need to use condom. And Sandra's like repeating back his line, like, no, it's like you said, I want to be empowered. And he's like, okay. And again, he's like sighing, like, oh, we have to use condom. It's like, bitch, that was the, like, of course you use the condom. The condom is why she's there, right? You know, it's like, you were fumbling this so much. But, you know, he puts it on, Sandra gets on top, and he tells her, he immediately barks at her. Turnover. So you like fuck her doggy style. And he takes off while she's turning over, he takes off the condom and slingshots it across the room. So now she does not know this is happening. No,
that's assault.
Right, exactly. And they have sex for like a comedically long time for hours. And when he wakes up in the morning, Sandra's gone, but she's left a message in lipstick reading, call me, and her phone number. Allison, he just wipes it away. However, as soon as he does, he's suddenly extremely nauseous. Let's just say he's sick in the morning. He runs to the bathroom to vomit, only for Connor to bust in like, dude, you fucked that girl Sandra? And he's like, of course I did. And he said, that's number 67, isn't it? You fucked 67 girls while you're here in college. And he's like, yeah, I guess you're right. And Connor looks down and Jake has like a visible rash like over the waistband of his underwear. And he's like, did you not use a condom? Like, you absolutely should get that checked out. And Jake's like, you know, it's probably like friction. It's just like a rash or something. But he does immediately go to the campus clinic.
Okay. Okay.
He's trying to be responsible. And, he's going to get what's coming to him for taking out the condom, of course. And,
fabulous.
And he's looking at the STD pamphlet, and he's like, I think I have HPV. And it's like, is this genital warts or something? And we meet the doctor, Dr. Kubler, who's going to appear in a couple of the stories. And he's like, oh, I'm sure it's fine. Nothing that a shot of penicillin can't fix. Let me just look at your lab work. Because ostensibly, he already had lab work done. And the doctor looks at the file and says, there must be some kind of mix-up. Which is what you want to hear a doctor say when you're there for a STI, you know?
Confusion is always top of the emotions you want to hear from a medical professional.
My files are all mixed. Weird. Files are all goofed up. It's like, Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
But, you know, he has Jake lay down and he uses a stethoscope to listen to Jake's abdomen. And Allison, unfortunately, something inside of it moves. Jake sees the doctor panicking, and the doctor runs out of the room to find someone to consult with. Jake opens his files, Allison, and reads that he is pregnant.
Love it.
Now, he doesn't do the logical thing, which is, and to be fair, maybe if this is the 60s, like, where can you get an abortion?
Right.
But I do appreciate that he does take this seriously, and he does the logical thing, and he gets what is called Plan C. And it's funny, because, like, Plan C is actually getting an abortion, you know?
Right.
But he is treating it as a pregnancy. Like, he's like, I don't know how I'm pregnant, but I am, you know?
Yeah, right. I need to not be.
Unfortunately, when he takes the pill, he immediately vomits back up. He's so nauseous. And when he takes off his shirt, his abdomen is growing at, like, an extremely rapid rate, right? Like, this is not a nine-month situation. This is, like, a 48-hour business.
Something is gestating and quickly.
And realizing, like, oh, my God, it's this woman Sandra I slept with. He struggles to try to read the number on the mirror that he wiped off. So he keeps, like, dialing all the numbers, but they're all wrong because he can't read it until finally he gets Sandra and he says, hey, Sandra, it's Jake. And she says, who? And he's like, it doesn't matter. We met at the party. Do you want to hang out today? I'm free. And she's like, yeah, I guess so. And she gives him her address. Allison, he goes downstairs to leave. He looks like he's 8 months pregnant and he also looks horrible. Like, he's fighting back nausea, right?
Yes.
When he walks downstairs, a row of hooded figures are standing there before him.
Oh, no.
They pull back their hoods. It's just his frat brothers in their ceremonial robes, and Todd is sort of like the head of the frat guys, and they're celebrating him for hitting the number 67, having sex with 67 women.
No. Put it back.
Which represents the 67 founders of our great fraternity and is honored with the 67 cherry trees spread across this great land. 67 cherries for Sig Delt.
And Jake is, by the way, sweating and holding his massive pregnant belly, trying to act barf. Normal. He's like, ha ha, thanks, guys, cool.
Are they not acknowledging that he looks like he's 8 months pregnant?
No, they are not at all. Okay. And they force him to get into a chair. And so the idea is, like, they give him a pendant with his last name on it, and then they hoist him up to the rafters, and he can stick the pendant to the rafters, right? But they try to lift him up, but he's, like, unfathomably heavy, and everyone's struggling. And finally, they lift him up. Also, Jake looks like he's about to vomit the entire time, right? And he's like, ha! Ah! And finally, he puts his pendant on the mantle, and then he just can't take it anymore. He fucking screams, and he sprays everyone from between his legs with a thick white goo. I think we're supposed to think that's like his water breaking, right?
Yes.
And everyone's reaction is just to silently put him down. And he says to Todd, give me your keys. And Todd hands them his keys. And then no one says anything when he leaves, which is actually what would happen if that happened.
At 100%.
Because I was just like,
it'd be that or a lot of screaming and no other activity, because you'd be just focused on screaming.
So Jake speeds over to Sandra's place, and he meets Ralph and Margaret, Sandra's parents, who see the condition that he's in. And they go, Sandra Marie, get your ass down here. You've got to be kidding me. They apparently know exactly what's going on, right?
Oh, no.
So they have Jake get up on a table with built-in stirrups, because this has happened before. And Sandra sheepishly enters, like, oh, I'm sorry, Mom and Dad. And Jake's screaming. He's like, what did you do to me? And Sandra's like, I thought you wore protection. Like, how did this happen? And they all turn in.
Oh, interesting.
And Jake's like, oh, well, I didn't. You have to understand. He goes, oh, you have to understand. I used to be really, really fat, which I'm sorry is so fucking funny.
That is really funny.
And he's like, kids used to tease me. Girls like you wouldn't even look at me, and I lost weight, and it got better for me, but then I got worse. And what's even worse than that is now I'm fat again. And Sandra goes to the landline and makes a call and says, whatever boy she's talking to is like, looks like I am free after all, and hangs on the phone. And Jake starts screaming. He goes into labor. So Ralph and Margaret are there, sort of his midwife and mid-husband, I guess. And Jake's screaming, how does this work? How is it going to come out of me? And Ralph looks at Margaret. Margaret goes, it's going to come out of you the same way it came in. Jake screams. The baby is arriving. Allison, we see it's a split second, but we see his penis literally split open as the baby is birthed, and blood sprays against the wall. And also his abdomen rips open. Right. So we see them basically taking a little baby from his abdominal cavity. Margaret cleans it up and takes it up to the nursery and puts it down as it sleeps, and then slowly tries to creep away, but then steps on a squeaky toy. And when she does, it wakens not just that baby, but all the babies in the room. And we look, it's a huge, like the full attic of a house.
Is it a human baby?
It is a humanoid baby. And in sort of in profile, we see 20 of these monster babies. Some of them have tentacles. Like some of them are just like creatures, but they're all little tiny baby monsters, which means she's out here fucking all those missing guys, right? And giving birth to all of these monstrous humans. Back at the mortuary, Sam says, that story had everything and I loved it and I really enjoyed it. And Montgomery says, are you making fun of me? She's like, no. I mean, like, it wasn't the best story I've ever heard, but I did. It had romance. It had sex. It had everything you need.
Suspense.
And Montgomery steps. He's like, I'm going to step out of the viewing room. Do not touch anything. Mm-hmm. Of course, as soon as he leaves the viewing room, Allison, Sam hears a thumping from inside the child's coffin. She goes over to it, and suddenly there's all this banging and clanging, and the coffin starts lowering into the floor. So there's basically a mechanism to lower it right into the actual morgue, which is pretty clever.
Okay.
And she peers over as the mechanism lowers it, and Montgomery is suddenly behind her and says, be careful. I wouldn't want you to take a tumble. And I have something about his delivery. Like, every line is great, but there's, like, take a tumble is, like, flows so trivially off his tongue. I loved it. And he tells her, this is, it continues the tour. He's like, this house has everything, all the modern conveniences from 1885. They go down to the embalming room where there is a body on the slab. And he tells her, every corpse tells a story and it's our task to listen. Take care to give this one a try. He pulls down the sheet. It's a beautiful woman who soon learned is named Carol. And Sam's like, well, she looks perfect. And Montgomery says, ah, look again. And he pulls aside, and on her side, she has bed sores. He also tells Sam that she has traces of magnesium in her mouth, which is a treatment for patients in a perpetual catatonic state. Mm. Sam looks again, trying to figure out, like, what other clues are on this body? And she says that she uses a wedding ring. And she pulls off the corpse's wedding ring, and inside it says, till death do we part. And Montgomery says, ah, but what if death provides no reprieve? Which brings us to our next segment, till death. We open on this woman, this corpse, Carol Peters, getting married at the altar with her husband, Wendell Owens, as they exchange vows. And literally the priest is saying, until death do we part. Wendell looks over and Carol's fighting for breath under her veil. She turns to him and screams, and the scream wakes Wendell up. He's just having a dream. Unfortunately, he is caring for Carol, who is in a catatonic state, and there's no explanation for what happened to her or what she was dealing with. She's able to eat on her own and drink water, but she is not communicative or alert in that way. And so he's coughing and choking, and he runs over and he like puts a little bit of water in her mouth, and she stops coughing. She has like a oxygen tube and a breathing machine. She's in their home, which is at least nice. Like they don't have to be at the hospital.
Okay.
But Wendell's life is sort of, he goes to work and then he goes home and takes care of Carol, right?
Yes.
So on his way back to the grocery store, he's got a bunch of food. He runs to his neighbor, Mrs. Avery, and she's telling him, like, oh my God, I went on this all-inclusive cruise. It was so incredible. And she says, have you ever been on an all-inclusive cruise? And he's like, oh, no, I take care of my catatonic wife. Not a lot of cruises in my life.
Yeah, we haven't been going on a lot of trips.
Yeah, the fees of the catatonia, there's catatonia fees added to the ticket. It's insurmountable. And Mrs. Avery said, well, you know, when my Arthur was alive, we never went anywhere. But now that he's dead, I'm seeing the world. Anyway, something to think about.
Oh,
I know.
Oh, okay.
She says, are you going up in the elevator? He's like, I hate elevators. But especially this old creepy one. And it's one of those old creepy, it's like, looks like an old hospital elevator. Like there's something about it. Like it has a little round window. Yeah. Yeah. So Wendell goes, he walks up 12 flights to their fucking apartment, which couldn't be me. And he starts preparing food. So basically he prepares a meal for both of us and then he purees the food for Carol. Because she's able to swallow, but it doesn't seem like she's really able to really chew much.
Eating and, yeah.
This is their routine. He goes to work, he comes back, makes himself dinner, makes her dinner, purees it, feeds it to her. And is really doing a good job, like the best he possibly can. I mean, like he's clearly very depressed, as anyone would be, but like is taking care of her. And one day he's feeding Carol and she seems to say something. And so it really gets Wendell's hopes up. Like, is she communicating? Unfortunately, he goes in to listen and she spits the soup back at his face, like just burping it up.
Okay.
After dinner, he goes through all their bills. Again, this is America. They're all overdue. Yeah. She has all these medical bills. He's like, I can't pay these. And we see that Carol's doctor, the same Dr. Kubler, who apparently worked at the college campus. And I'm like, I guess he had a career change, or is there just one doctor in this town and he has to do double duty? He stops by to check on Carol. And he's like, well, she's developing some bed sores, but I can show you how to like move her on the bed so it doesn't develop in the same spot. But I'll be honest, she's doing really well. And he's like, okay. Oh my God, how is that possible? Is she improving? And she's like, oh no, that's what I'm saying. I'm just saying I would give her at least a year, possibly more. Oof. And he's like, I don't know how I'm supposed to make this work. Like, I can't afford what I, like, I you know, like, right. She still needs all this medical help and she's on medication. I don't know what to do. Dr. Kubler writes, or basically hands Wendell a strong pain medication and says, more than two of these at once, she would die. And Wendell's like, okay, great. I'll add it to all the other fucking medication, you know, but I'll be sure just not to give, I'll just give her one at a time, obviously. And the doctor says, no, what I'm saying is, if you were to give her more than two of these at once, she would die. And also they're untraceable. And were she to eat them, she would simply drift off to sleep and be a very peaceful death.
Ugh, that's all I want.
And Wendell says, oh. And Dr. Kubler says, oh, before leaving. So that night, he has Carol sit at the table with him. Usually she's in bed and he brings her food. And he sort of like put her like in a nice dress and they're having dinner together.
Going right to it.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, no, we're not wasting time. This is like, as soon as the doctor leaves, like, all right, I can still make all that right, cruise at least tomorrow. Dinner.
Right.
Yeah, going on one of those Disney cruises. Going to Hedonism 2 in Jamaica. So he puts her up at the table, and he gives her a gift, and it is an Arctic hare. And he's like, I know you love the Arctic hare, and it used to sort of cheer you up, and it was sort of like, it's sort of like there's an SNL sketch about like when you become a mom, like you get like an animal that's assigned to you, and then everyone just buys you stuff, and it's like,
oh yeah.
And for my mother, which she fought this tooth and nail, but we had wiener dogs growing up, and so people would buy us wiener dog stuff, and it's like we have dogs that are wiener dogs. We do not need our own life. We don't need a wiener dog life, you know. Which I mean, listen, everyone has a different relationship to their animal, but. So her thing was an Arctic hare. So it's like a very like little, it's like a pointy golden statuette of a rabbit, a hare looking up. And he's like, I know that used to cheer you up. And he tells Carol, I can't do this alone anymore. Could you please give me a sign that you're there? But of course she can't.
Right.
So he just starts getting more and more upset. He's begging her like, do it. Show me something. Do it now, Carol. And he starts screaming at her. But then he apologizes. He's like, I'm so sorry. I know that this is not your fault. Allison, he just starts popping open those pills and dumping them into her soup. Puts at least five or six in there, right?
All right. Well, you know, if you're going to do it.
I mean, complicated. I mean, Liz, I don't want to have my desire for someone to absolutely do this for me to color our understanding of the ethics of this. This is morally wrong. Now, if they had a conversation when she was getting sick.
Where she's like, do this if I'm ever this.
Yeah, and I want to say, you know, I'm not dating yet, but when I do start dating, I will tell anyone I date on the first date, please feel free. Like, if I'm in this situation, like, no question.
Wrap it up.
I want this to be very clear. But he lifts the bowl in her mouth, he starts feeding her soup. We also see, like, as he does it, there's all these other hare statues around the apartment, and they're all, like, watching him, and it's like another spoonful, and then another hare, and they're all, like, the little eyes around him. Of course, as soon as he finishes the bowl and puts the bowl down, Carol's hand flexes and grabs his arm. And he screams as he starts seizing. And then, of course, he realizes, like, "What? Oh, my God, what have I done?" And he starts giving her the Heimlich and forces her to vomit up the soup. And he's like, I'm so sorry. I feel horrible. Like, realizing what he's done. And when he's sort of, like, she falls forward onto the table. And when he lifts her back up, the Arctic hare statue has been driven into her eye socket, by the force of her falling, Allison, she is dead. She is unfortunately now dead of what is clearly a horrific injury versus an untraceable pill.
Yeah.
He calls...
Not great.
Yeah, he calls Dr. Kubler in a fucking panic. It's like, she fell on Arctic hair. I don't know what to do. And Dr. Kubler says, okay. You have to get that body out of the apartment. You have to throw it in the fucking ocean and pray the sharks do the rest and never call me again. And hangs up. Allison, I'm asking you at this point in time, what would you do?
What would you do?
I would not throw a body in the ocean and like finger crossed it works out. Like, I just don't trust the world enough for that not to end up.
I don't trust sharks at all. I don't trust them.
I
don't trust sharks.
I mean, and we shouldn't. I think that I would call like 911 and I would lay out the story that she was eating her soup. She started choking. I gave her the Heimlich.
Yeah.
She fell. This happened. It's an accident. And like just set up like that this is an accident and this is like, a terrifying consequence of like what I was trying to do was to save, you know, just like get ahead of the story a little bit.
Yeah. And like, I guess it's like, would they test the soup? But I guess if it's untraceable, maybe it wouldn't show up. But I don't, that's probably not a real, that's not an accurate
way. I mean,
I
would assume also like for someone, if they're I would assume that choking is a possible normal thing that could be happening, that it wouldn't raise suspicion.
Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah, I definitely wouldn't do what he's about to do, which is is going to stuff her in a chest and her legs don't fit. So he takes out an electric saw like you'd cut a turkey with.
Oh, sure.
And before he does, he looks at their wedding album and sees like all these beautiful photos. Literally, you've just looked at your wedding album and now you're going to cut your wife's legs off with an electric saw. Allison, he starts to cut them off right at the knee. As soon as the saw hits her leg, she wakes up screaming. And, like, jerks up out of the chest.
How?
She wasn't dead. She was just badly injured. And in his panic, he grabs the hair. And so when she falls back, the hair gets pulled out of her eye socket, which starts gushing blood. So now she's dead because she's bleeding out from her eye socket. And she falls back into the chest. She's dead now. But, to be fair, now he can actually dismember her under the watchful eye of these Arctic hares.
True.
Puts her in the chest and takes her to the elevator. Of course, as soon as he hits the elevator, this couple also on his floor is like, hold the door, hold the door. And he's like pressing like the door closed, like, no, 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 no. Of course, luckily, right before he gets the other couple gets on, he's fine. The elevator starts to descend, and then it gets stopped at floor 9 and it will not go further. And he starts to panic and he ends up prying open the elevator door and he sees Mrs. Avery. And she's like, oh my God, is that damn elevator broke again? You're right. This is a horrible elevator. I'm going to call the police to come help you. And he's like, please don't call the police. I'm fine. I'm sure the elevator will be working in momentarily. And she's like, I'm going to call the police anyways. Allison, the doors close. And when Wendell looks down, it's still not moving. Blood is just draining out the bottom of the chest. So the floor of the elevator is covered in blood. There is no way around it. And he's trapped in the elevator. Desperate, Wendell is like, what do I do? What are the options? If the police are coming, they're going to find me here and they're going to be like, what's in the chest where all the blood's coming out of? You know?
Yeah, that would be question one.
Not to give the cops that much credit, but like, you know, it might
I think
come
they
up.
Could hopefully piece that together.
So he stands in the chest to try to push the panel out of the top of the elevator, but he slips and falls onto the ground. So now he's covered in blood, like soaked in blood himself.
So now even if he were to get out of there... It's like, you can't walk down the street and be like, what, who, me?
Yeah,
like,
they would piece
you're covered
it together.
In blood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's just like, now he just starts to have a breakdown. He takes out his wedding ring and he screams, I wish I had never. And of course he stops himself before he said, married you. But then he throws his wedding ring across the elevator. Just then, Allison, he hears a moan from inside the box and the lid pops open. Just then the elevator drops and it starts dropping fast. Like, it's just zooming past, like, the normal floors. It hits the lobby, hits the garage, hits the basement, and then it keeps going, right? And he runs to the little window, and instead of seeing the floors pass, he sees memories from happier times with Carol, being able to chew, proposing to her, laughing, her not having an Arctic hare stabbed in her eye, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The elevator starts dropping so fast that the blood starts flying up in the air, like, in droplets, and he and the case start floating. So it's basically, like, it's dropping so fast that he's becoming weightless. Suddenly, because the case, and the little lid starts to pop open, Carol's corpse flies out alongside him, and her face is now this grotesque corpse parody of her face with a streaming bloody eye socket. Like, the blood, it's flowing up. And she flies to him, and she's holding his wedding ring and puts it back on his finger before kissing him. And they're sort of kissing and floating. And the best part of what I thought is, like, so she's kissing him, and then he just, like, goes in and he embraces her, and they're just, like, he's kissing her back. Finally, the police open the door, and they find Wendell on the floor, and he's holding his wedding album next to the trunk, and he's mumbling to himself, "In sickness and in death, till death we be part. In sickness and in death, till death do we part." Back at Ravensend, Montgomery has a huge smile on his face, like, "That was a good one, huh?" And Sam goes, "I didn't like that story." And his face, like, oh, like, just, like, immediately deflated. Yeah. And he's like, he was punished for doing what anyone would do. And Montgomery's like, well, that's an interesting way to look at it. The point of what the story is, like, he couldn't escape his fate. Like, once things were in motion, then this is what's going to happen.
Okay.
And she's like, well, what happened to him? Like, did he go to prison? He's like, yeah, he's actually committed to the Kirksdale Asylum, a vile and tragic place.
Okay.
Sam lifts a little hand statue, and she goes, also, what's this? And he's like, oh, you'd be surprised what we find in people's colons. So I think it was just, like, a piece of, like, something collected from a different body.
Yuck.
So he then takes Sam into the building's sub-basement, which is built, because, like, this was built in the 1800s. They didn't have, like, giant refrigerators, so it's, like, it has to be so far down into the earth that, like, it's a natural refrigerator.
Terrible.
I know. It's horrifying to think about. And it was built to keep the bodies cool. And so they go, and the child's coffin has been lowered from the viewing room back into the sub-basement. And, Sam says to Montgomery, like, I'll be honest, like, the stories you told are kind of the same. Like, it is about the universe, like, morally punishing you. And, like he said, like, universal balance, like, the idea that there is, you know, justice. And he says, it's a timeless tale that needs to be retold. No evil deed goes unpunished. And he tells her, you're going to love this part. And they go to wheel the kid's coffin into the crematorium. And he says,
this poor soul's journey has come to an end. Dust we started, dust we return.
Wait!
She stops and says, no, wait. I lied. I'm not here for the job. I'm here for this child. You say every evil deed goes unpunished, but you're wrong. In real life, bad guys get away with it all the time. And Logan, the child inside the coffin, is proof. She starts sobbing and telling him, like, it's all my fault. Can I see him one last time?
Ooh.
And Montgomery lifts the lid. And Sam looks down at the body of it, Montgomery, and says, I want to tell you a story. So here's a story. We see a girl named Faye babysitting a little girl, Sally. As Sally goes to bed, and Faye's boyfriend, Bart, calls to convince her, basically, like, let me come over so we can make out. And he says on the call, it also just doesn't seem safe for you to be all alone with that psycho on the loose. It's never good in a small town. When there's a psycho on the loose.
Yeah, it's like, you gotta get together.
Right. Yeah. Actually, come over. How much trouble can I get in when there's a psycho on the loose? You know what I mean?
Right.
Faye says, of course, like, no, you can't come over. I don't want to get in trouble. Like, just put an ice pack on it. Like, you know. And so then we switch to the killer's POV. And there's a killer watching Faye inside the house. And we get a proper, like, 80s killer title card that says, The Babysitter Murders. And we see a killer in sort of like a black cloth hooded mask, putting a mask over it. It's a little porcelain doll mask sort of strapped to his head with leather straps. And that is my coworker, Ben Heathcote.
Shout out to Ben.
Which, again, you would never know because you do not see this killer's face. But I was like, what a fun. And I also produced the movie. But what a fun cameo to get to play a part in. So shout out to you, Ben. And we see this, the killer sort of start creeping towards the house. We actually see that what we're watching is an actual movie. And the person watching the movie is Sam. So she's on the couch watching it. And again, a beautiful house. And we see in the movie, like, Bart.
That whole thing was in the movie. Okay.
Yeah. So she's watching a movie, right? And then we'll find herself in a similar situation. Sam walks into the kitchen to see there's a voicemail, and it's the Kublers. So this is actually the Kublers' house, and their son, Lucas, is asleep upstairs. And they say, hey, Sam, we're going to be late. Can you just check on Lucas? He's got in this habit of, like, he'll go to bed, but then he'll get up in the middle of the night, and he'll just be playing in his closet. So just go make sure that he's actually asleep. But other than that, like, eat whatever you want in the house. Like, have fun. Sam goes to check on Logan. He's snoozing. And she returns to the kitchen and turns on, like, music, which seems stupid. That's, like, not a babysitter move, right?
Yeah.
She also starts making something from scratch, which is the only thing you eat is pizza or stuff that's already in the house. To make something from scratch is a bizarre move during a babysitting evening, right? Mm-hmm. And also, this kitchen has everything. There's literally a meat grinder. There's, like, I mean, like, every possible knife. There's a lot of accoutrement that is going to come into play, right?
Scary.
Because she's cooking and has the music on, she doesn't hear the breaking news, like, breaking into the babysitter murders movie. And it says, there's a riot at Kirksdale Asylum following a power outage. We've heard reports that one of the inmates may have escaped. And the reporter interviews the police deputy, and we see one of the other officers is Wendell, who we just saw. And the deputy says, we can't verify if anyone's escaped, but we ask you to use an abundance of caution, so just lock your doors and stay inside. Mm-hmm. The news cuts back to the movie just as the killer in the movie cuts the power. Meanwhile, the power in the house that Sam is in starts to flicker as a storm rolls in, of course. You gotta have a storm rolling in. She takes out the trash, and when she walks back in from the porch, we see one of the windows has been broken in.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we hear sort of the voiceover from the horror movie of the killer, and as Sam walks back into the living room, Allison, she finds a soaking wet man bleeding from a head wound sitting on the sofa, just sort of gasping to himself. Sam rushes to the kitchen for a butcher knife, but when she turns around, the man is there and startles her, and she drops it. And he says, can you help me? This isn't my house.
No shit.
And the phone starts to ring. And Sam's like, you know, but they're kind of in the stalemate. And he's just acting strangely. He's not, like, really acting aggressively. And so she grabs a towel and tries to, like, dab the man's head, like, where he's bleeding. And he says,
"That's nice of her.
What are you doing?" Finally, the answering machine picks up. And you get the worst fucking voicemail you could possibly get, which is Mrs. Kubler screaming. She says, why are you answering the fucking phone? They're saying that killer escaped. The one who mutilated and killed all those kids. Lock the doors and stay with Logan.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
And we see both the man and Sam look around the room to see, like, children's drawings, a little bunny, like, realizing there's a kid in the house. Sam grabs this man's hand, jams into the meat grinder, and then just starts meat grinding his hand before picking up a meat tenderizer and bashing him across the face. Unfortunately, he's bigger than her and, like, it's on, right? So they're fucking brawling. He kicks her, like, basically in the stomach, and she flies across the room. He's able to get his hand out of the meat grinder. And he staggers in the living room, screaming incoherently. And the phone rings. He's able to answer the phone, but he's just screaming, right? He's so incoherent. Right. Sam leaps on him, and he sort of is able to slam her into the wall and bites off his ear before he flips her over his shoulder and smashes her through a coffee table, knocking her unconscious.
So physical.
Yeah, right away. Like, it is like WWE Raw in here. In the movie, the porcelain doll-faced killer butchers the teens, and then we see him going up the stairs after the little girl. Okay. In reality, or our reality of the film,
yes.
We also see the man making his way up the stairs as Sam wakes up from her unconsciousness, and we see, like, the parallel to her to the final girl waking up. Sam grabs a fireplace poker and then busts in on the killer, on the man, who is standing over Lucas's bed, which is empty. And he looks at her and he's like, where's the boy? And she looks and he follows her eyes to the closet. Allison, the power goes out and Sam attacks him. Sam just swings at the man. And they are tearing that room apart, like, feathers everywhere, like, bedding. He punches her full in the face, like, throws her against the wall. And finally, she's able to escape the room and is crawling down the hallway just as the Kublers arrive home. Unfortunately, she has, the chain lock on, so they cannot immediately get into the door, so they have to run to the back of the house.
Terrific.
And she's able to make it to the top of the second floor land, like, right near the stairs. And the man's on top of her and grabs her by the throat, strangling her, and says, where is the boy? And he's strangling her, and she tells him, don't do this, you're not a killer. And he starts sobbing, and he's like, you're right, I'm not. And he stands up, and Sam follows him to the top of the stairs, and he tells her, this is over. And she says, you're right. And she shoves him over the stairwell landing, sending him pinwheeling to the floor below. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the Kooblers are still running around the house trying to get in. In the movie, we see our final girl, Faye, and little girl, Sally, hug, only for the killer to awaken. Similarly, we are looking at the man's face, covered in blood. His eyes snap open. Mm-hmm. And Sam is...
No one's ever dead until they're dead.
Exactly. And Sam stands over him holding like what a big old... Their TV, which is like a big old-fashioned tube TV. She says, mm-hmm. This is for ruining my dinner. And she smashes the TV down onto his face, crushing his skull. The Kooblers run in. Sam is nowhere to be seen. And they scream, oh my God, who is that? And Dr. Kubler picks up the TV and Mrs. Kubler screams, oh my God, it's Sam, the babysitter. Sam, of course, being a gender neutral name.
Yes.
Sam was in fact the man who was watching Lucas. And of course, we see on the TV news confirming that a killer did escape from the asylum. Her name is Charlotte Gibbons. She's known as the Boggy Bay Tooth Fairy. She's convicted of 12 counts of murder and 10 counts of cannibalism for eating children. And of course, they show her mugshot. That is the woman we have known as Sam this whole time.
This whole time.
Her name is actually Charlotte. And so Dr. Kluber goes in. There's smoke coming out of the oven. Like, whatever she put in was still there. And his wife's screaming that she can't find their son. Allison, they open the door. And you see sort of, like, in relief. It looks like we have, like, a rack of lamb. Like, you can see the mm-hmm. rib cage. They open the door, and they scream.
Oh.
Back at Raven's Edge, Montgomery laughs and says, I see what you did there. A very funny line. He says, you buried the lead to throw me off. And he's like, okay, so if you're the killer, why would you come back? And Sam, who was actually Charlotte, says, you have your collection of stories. I have my collection. She takes a hunting knife out, and we don't see it, obviously, but basically jams it into Lucas's jaw and pries out one of Lucas's teeth and takes it as a souvenir.
She's there for teeth.
She's there to take a child's tooth that killed and was going to eat part of his body.
Did you see Sharp Objects? Did you watch that?
No, I did read it and I liked it, but I tried to watch the show again. I was just so bummed out. I just wasn't. But it was good though. I remember. It was good. Yeah.
But again, teeth are part of it.
A lot of teeth stuff.
A lot of teeth stuff.
Sam says to Montgomery, you won't tell anyone, will you? And he says, of course not. But of course, that's not enough for her. She stabs him in the torso and he sort of collapses to the ground. She's like, I'm sorry, but in real life, the bad guy does usually win. Of course, Allison, as she turns to leave, Montgomery starts laughing maniacally and tells her, oh, I loved it, but you've committed the one storytelling sin. You've underestimated your audience. And when he takes his hands away from his torso, of course, there's no blood, but instead a thick, bright green ooze emerging from his torso, and the room starts to shake. And he tells her, congratulations, the job is yours. Sam runs out the front door to escape, only to find when she opens the door and walks through, she's walking back into the funeral home, right? So she cannot actually leave anymore. Yeah. And Montgomery, he keeps appearing behind her in different places. Like, there's no use in running. She springs past him into the library, which is full of books, full of stories of all these people who have died and passed through the mortuary. And Montgomery appears sort of on like a landing above her and says, I was just like you. I thought I was a traveler on the edge of human experience. Shout out to Hellraiser. I thought I was immune. I thought I was above morality until I found myself here in this assignment. This library is full of stories. And Sam, what I think is going to be tough for you is a lot of these stories are yours. And as we see, a dozen books fall off the shelf and fall open. And out of their pages crawl the burning blackened corpses of her child cannibalism victims.
Holy shit.
Including a literal baby who is crawling towards her. And Montgomery tells her, no one escapes their fate. And Sam screams back, no, I am the master of my fate. I decide how my story ends. And Montgomery says, no, my girl, your story is just beginning. And the kids all descend on her and start like tearing her apart with their remaining teeth, shredding her and devouring her.
Christ. I mean, good.
Absolutely. Later.
Horrifying.
Later, we see Montgomery working in the lab late this night. And in the morning, he's back in his office as dawn breaks, and he lifts the hood off of the preserved butterfly, and its wings start flapping. And the butterfly is allowed to leave, which, of course, he takes as a sign that I could probably leave. And he opens the door and walks outside, seemingly for the first time in decades. Seems like he's been there at least, like, if not 100 years, close to.
Yeah.
And he walks out. Unfortunately, Allison, as soon as he gets hit by a beam of light, he fucking explodes into a thousand pieces and turns into ash. Meanwhile, back on the slab, Sam, who knows Charlotte, wakes up and she looks into a mirror and she shrieks. She is sort of a patchwork person that Montgomery has sewed back together and Frankensteined. Oh, and outside, the help wanted sign falls off onto the grass. And we see her sometime in the future, now behind, now sort of giving a look, sort of Victorian, she has makeup on to cover her scars.
Okay.
She shuts the book that she's been reading this whole movie from, and she is sitting across from the newspaper boy who is taking notes on the story. And he says, I should probably get going. And Sam stands and smiles and says, oh, but I was just about to make dinner. The mortuary collection.
Wow.
Allison, what are some fatal mistakes you think people may have made in these stories?
Fatal mistakes.
Here, we could run it down. You know, the overall arch, well, we'll do that one last, actually. So the first story, Octopus Void behind the medicine cabinet.
Don't fuck, real fuck around and find out vibes there. You know, you don't just go through other people's stuff. As much as we want to see what's inside everybody's medicine cabinet, even if it comes a knocking, it's just not your business.
I always think of it, I don't know if anyone's actually ever done this or if this is from a sitcom, like the idea, like, so you open a medicine cabinet, it's full of marbles. So as soon as you open it, everyone knows you did it because all the marbles fall over the place. Is that a real thing?
That's like a thing. I don't know if it's a real thing or if it's a TV thing, but I know it, that's.
Also, like, how would you do that? Yeah, I have a lot of questions. Yeah,
seems very complicated. And then the college one, don't fucking take off a condom when you're fucking somebody. I'm sorry. That is assault. You should be in jail.
I don't think you should be sorry about that. I think we all know that, right? I think we all know that by now.
We all know that. That guy kind of had what was coming to him, and I don't feel a ton of sadness for him.
I do wonder about it. Like, for me, it's like Sandra. It's like, Sandra, what's the plan here? What are you doing? You know what I mean? Like, you keep having all of these kids.
Yeah. Like, what's going on with you that you can get a man pregnant?
Well, yeah, we're never going to be able to answer that. And, like, with your family? Also, it's like, it implies the family didn't give her enough information. Because it's not like the family's like, oh, excited. Like, oh, good. We need her to do this to propagate her species. They're like, Sandra, come on. Rein it in.
Yeah.
Which is a very funny, but I guess a funnier option.
And then the don't kill your spouse.
Yeah.
They haven't told you that that's what they want if they're in a catatonic state. Yeah. That is not your decision to be making.
Exactly. Relationships are all about communication. So if your spouse wants you to kill them, they will communicate that to you. I think we feel...
Also, if you've been married for a long time, like, end-of-life planning and living wills are really important to have in place.
I also think, and maybe this is like, I understand what we're supposed to like be like, oh, you know, another year doesn't sound that long. Like, I feel like it must be grueling, but it is not, it's not like it's like, oh, it's, not, it's 15 it, years. It's I don't not, know.
Yeah. It's not killer.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree. It's not a killer time frame. And then the story about Sam, the babysitter killer story.
Oh yes. Well,
Which is a great title because it's like, oh, it's a babysitter killer, but it's also a babysitter killer.
Babysitter killer.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I get, like, having kids? No.
I know. It's like Sam, the babysitter, he couldn't have known that there was going to be this asylum break.
Right. And, like, it all feel, yeah. That one, I feel like everybody...
It's kind of out of their hands.
In a scenario that they couldn't control except for the real Sam or Charlotte or whoever. And then, you know, she really got what was coming to her and don't be a murderer, you dumbass.
Yeah, I think once you're killing and cannibalizing kids, and this is like, I think speaks to, for me, like this is, I think something we talked about on the podcast, but I was like, well, but she can't really be like a child murderer and a cannibal. She's too hot. Like she's like a hot blonde. I was like, I'm sorry. Hot blondes are not going to cannibalize people. But that's
you don't need that.
But also, it's like that's what I'm carrying in the world. You know what I mean? Like, ugly person. Oh, an ugly person would need a baby. Okay, everyone has to be fat bastard. You know, come on, grow up. Hot people can eat babies too.
Everybody, they can do anything.
They could do anything we could do.
Yeah.
The hot and the ugly must join forces to not eat babies. That's all I'm asking.
I think that's the moral of this entire film. Yes. And a lesson we should all take moving forward.
And then finally, where would you put the mortuary collection on the spooky scale, Allison?
A spooky scale.
I feel like this had like real highs and lows, like real silly moments that like, and like, again, like anthologies are tough because like the seeping feeling of dread that I think usually kicks things up a couple notches doesn't exist when you have such short stories and films. But like, I think that this is like solidly like a 5.
Okay, great.
I think like some real gross stuff and some real horrific behavior. But again, like all kinds of kooky characters and kind of the umbrella of like stories within stories just takes me out of it a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about you?
Wait. What number did you pick?
I said 5.
5. I'm going to go 3. Because I really did like and was found spooky the babysitter killer, that segment. The thing about pregnancy, again, like, I really enjoyed this, and I thought also, like, the framing device was very clever, and I really enjoyed everyone's performance. But the moments of comedy, again, cuts the spookiness, which, again, because the spooky scale is merely how spooky you found something not to be enjoyed.
Not whether it was
enjoying it. I thought this was a 10. I thought this was an absolute blast. I had fun.
Super fun.
But in terms of actually scares, and I did find Till Death, so actually, I'm going to say a 4, because I do think Till Death really I found very unnerving and scary. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I'm going to give it a 4 and a 10 for pure pleasure. And not that that's a scale that we use. But thank you so much for listening.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm probably going to have to head back to the bathroom. So I'll let you go. But Allison, always a pleasure.
Oh, my God.
Please. Please. Until next time.
Keep it spooky.
Ruined is a Radio Point production with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, and Houston Snyder, recorded and edited by Kat Iosa.